Welcome to Pardon the Corruption. It's been a long time, but I think it's going to be worth the wait because today my guest is Casey Bannerman, who many of you already know because he's a pretty popular artist on Twitter and he's done a ton of work for the Raptors. And just if you check out his profile online, you know exactly why he is so popular. So I'm very happy to be joined by Casey today. Welcome to Pardon the Corruption. By the way, if there's a better name for the show, let me hear it. But welcome.
Zerard, man, it's so nice to talk to you. I'm a huge fan of Raptors Republic, everything you do, which is a lot. You specifically, I see it. You don't go unnoticed. But thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So, man, I mean, I've been following your work for years now. And like, tell me the origin story of Casey Bannerman. Like, when did you realize that this is not just maybe a hobby, but a career? At what point in your life did you realize that I can take this to a new level and maybe even make a living out of it?
So first off, shouts to origin story, man. That's like very on brand for me. It's very comic books and everything. I'm not sure if you can see all my, like some of my favorites are behind me there. Origin story is deep. So I'll just do a brief synopsis. I was sort of working. I mean, as you said, you've been following my work for years, but I've only really been doing this professionally full time for about 2 and a bit years. So that year that Kawhi came was the year that I really sort of buckled down and just decided like, I'm going to do this for a living. Prior to that, I was sort of doing a lot of like web development, like just jobs I really didn't enjoy that were sort of creative adjacent, but very corporate. And at the time, something I'm like very open about, I was struggling with addiction and I just didn't know what was going on in my life. But grappling with that, sort of looking inside, realizing that that was maybe started from me not doing what I liked in life, I decided to do more art. And it wasn't like Raptors at first. I was like, oh, maybe I'll design some logos, but whatever I do, it has to be creative. And then I'm not sure if you remember, but do you remember the Art of the North event that they had?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
So for practice, I had been doing more Raptor-centric art and just putting on my profile because I was passionate about that, but that was mostly just to like try out new techniques and whatever. And the Raptors reached out to me, and then also the guy, Vince is his name, and he put on the show. He's based in New York, but I think he's from like Washington or something. Anyways, so he put on the show, and then I did that Art of the North event, and I just thought it was kind of a cool thing. And then out of nowhere, Fred VanVleet reached out to me about one of the pieces going like, hey man, this is like really dope. I want to put it on my merch, on my clothing line. So we started talking and that particular piece actually never made it to his clothing line. But as I'm sure some people have seen, at least maybe you have, I do a lot of work with Fred now. Mm-hmm. And his team, who are all super dope, super nice. Shout out to Quez and Jordan and Aramis and Darnell and all those guys, super dope. There on out, I just, you know, sort of took whatever opportunities were coming my way and just kept on trying to get better and better and better mm-hmm. and get to the level that I want to get to, which, you know, you never get to, but, you know, it's the constant pursuit of that.
Yeah. So now, I mean, you've gone from Fred to working with, like, I see some of the names here, like Kyle Lowry, Pascal Siakam, Danny Green, Phil Handy, the Raptors assistant. And you're even kind of touching on Ja Morant right now. And then bam. And was it like one particular opportunity that opened things up for you? Or was it just your word got around? Like, what was the kind of like the turning point, the TSN turning point where things kind of went up?
Yo, shouts to Fred, man. Like, Fred's the best. I just want everybody to know what an like absolute great guy he is. He for sure was the turning point. I would say, like, if I was to put my finger on one thing, it's not like Fred was in the locker room being like, yo, you gotta check out Casey or something like that. I mean, at least not to my knowledge, but him sort of I don't want to say like taking a chance on me, but seeing my work and being like, yo, I want that, made me decide to pursue more players. And at that time, Fred was and Fred was a great player. Like, that's why I used him. But Fred was like a bench guy. Like, remember beginning of start of the 2018-2019 season, like, he was a great bench guy. He was a lot of energy off the bench. You could see leadership. You could see, you know, him turning into that. But I don't know if we quite predicted. I mean, at least I didn't. I don't have, you know, the insight like you guys do that he would become who he is now. But even so, I think him taking a chance on me allowed me to sort of bet on myself, mm-hmm. you know, like in a roundabout way, which was kind of cool. And then from there, Pascal, like I for his All-Star game, I did that memory pendant with Shuli, a jeweler in Toronto. He and I collaborated on that, and that was for his All-Star game. And the piece on that was a dedication to him and his late father who passed away, which we, you know, most Raptors fans know that story.
So, I mean, that's amazing because Fred is sort of like that underdog guy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he is the ultimate, I don't want to say rags to riches story, but he has that feeling about him. And even the brands that he associates with, like And One, for example, And One was one of my favorite brands growing up because.
Yo, shout out to the Tai Chi, man. The Tai Chi shoe. Did you have that?
For sure. And I remember when my now wife met a woman, when we first met, I was wearing those.
And then
I'm going to go off on a tangent here. And then she introduced me to her sister at the time, and I was wearing the Tai Chi's. And I remember one of the comments that her sister gave my wife at the time was like, "Are you sure about this guy? Look at the shoes he's wearing."
I got that.
Are you out of your mind?
Comment.
These are amazing shoes.
Yeah, exactly. Straight up, amazing shoes. But I got that exact same comment. So my partner now, Kelsey, who is all the brains behind this, that you know doesn't get the shine, and she loves that. But she's definitely a part of making sure that everything gets organized and people get replied to, and she's the very best. Anyways, when we first met and started dating, she was introducing me to some of her friends, and a couple of them said the same thing. I think I had like these Jordan 7s on or something, and she was like, "Yo, is this guy like?" And we were going out to like some nice brunch, and I showed up in Jordan 7s. Like, I like fashion and shit like that, but I also like street fashion.
Yeah.
And they said the same thing. They were like, "Are you sure those sneakers, man? He doesn't look that serious."
Yeah.
And at the time, maybe I wasn't. Like, so who knows?
Yeah, I remember at the time I used to be into this brand called Triple Five Soul.
I know Triple Five Soul.
Out of New York. And it was just, anyways, so that's not a, that's not that, maybe that's a different episode.
That was almost sort of Echo days period. Remember Fat Farm and Echo and.
Yeah, exactly. I remember going on Young Street.
Fred, like to your point, Fred is very much that guy. Fred's a very good businessman. From my knowledge, I don't want to misportray our relationship. Like, we do talk and, you know, I reach out to him on his birthday and sometimes, you know, just for different opportunities and whatever, but, he's very much that guy. Like he sees, I think he just sees people who work hard, and that's the only thing I would pat myself on the back for, is like, if there's one thing I am, it's a hard worker. Like, I work from 9 to 5 and then 7 to 12 now, 'cause I got to work like when my manufacturers are up. To make all the art on my jerseys and stuff like that. So I think he recognized that even then. And he puts time into those people. And you can kind of see it. And I don't know, like, I have no inside info on this, but you can kind of see it with the guys that he gets close to on teams and stuff like that. It's like, it's the hard workers for sure. That's the one thing that Fred respects.
Let me ask you a question about like how your art is produced, because you know, I have a daughter, she's 11.
Yeah.
She's very much into digital art.
Awesome.
You know, she's also into like regular art and all that.
Yeah.
What is the process that you use when you create a graphic? Is it, do you go straight to digital or do you first play around with it on pen, or does it depend? Like, walk me through like how a commission goes from concept to complete.
Yeah. So I do do a lot of pencils. Let's see if I can find my sketchbook here. Yeah. All right. So I do a lot of pencils. This is one like I was just sort of trying to get because I hadn't drawn Bam and I'm working on a Bam piece right now yet. So I just had to get his likeness right. And this was my like sort of first attempt at it. And so I just do like, see the light. Can the light show it? Kind of.
Yeah, I don't know. I see it. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so I do pencils a lot. Digital does, like sometimes I go straight to digital if it's just coming out that way. Because the nice thing about digital is that, A, you're not getting any eraser marks. So you don't, like, you're never afraid to put down, like, another line or whatever. You can just, like, remove it or hit undo or whatever. But also, like, let's say I drew Bam's head, like, a little too narrow. I don't have to completely restart. I can sort of just stretch it out. Do you know what I'm saying? But the not benefit of digital is it's sort of like, you know, when people say like listening to vinyl, there's just that warmth to it, you know, like there's like some intangible there that you can just like feel it, whatever, or hear it rather. It's sort of the same thing when you're putting pencil onto a paper, there's just that tactile feeling and you feel like more of you is getting into the drawing. Mm-hmm. Like more of your personal style. Mm-hmm. So as much as I can, I like to start with pencils. And then what I do is I scan that up. I bring it into, I work, this is not like super standard, but I work entirely from an iPad Pro. Mm-hmm. A lot of people use these things called Wacom tablets and those are dope too, but I just started on an iPad. So that's the way I continued. And I do the inks and then I do the colors and then whatever I got to do after that. Like I did a jersey for Kyle's birthday. I did this 4-foot piece that it was for his jersey retirement, Nova. And Nova actually sent me his jersey, his official jersey and everything like that because they can't sell them, right? Because of the NCAA rules. And then I put that behind plexiglass. So it was sort of floating in this frame and I had to print it onto the plexiglass. So if that's the case, I send that off. Or if I'm doing art on a jersey, then I talk to my manufacturers for that. And there's a whole process. And yeah.
Yeah. I have a Wacom tablet.
There you go, man. Yeah. Wacoms are great. Yeah. Like if I had I started on a Wacom, like I think those are way more standard for sure. Had I started on them, I'd probably be with them. But I think that as I was sort of dipping my toes in the water, I had an iPad already for other things. And so I just ordered, I don't even know if they were iPad Pros at the time, but anyways, I ordered an Apple Pencil and I started with that. And then the iPad Pro came out and I was making a little bit of guap. Yeah. And so I said, okay, let's put some money into this and let's get serious. And that's, you know what, if there's any artists listening to this, that's, one of the main things I would tell them is like at the beginning, whatever you make, reinvest, like whatever you make, reinvest, just put it back in. And then eventually you'll get to a point where you'll have an allocated amount of, you know, capital that you can sort of put to that and keep some, you know, for your life and pay your rent and stuff like that. And that's the main thing. Yeah.
I guess it's about experimentation, right? See what works for you.
For sure.
Yeah, and I landed on the on this tablet, and I only obviously I'm not an artist, but I use this for when we do it on our YouTube channel when we do our play by play breakdown, and you got to circle
sure.
the players and all that.
Yeah,
it comes in quite handy for this. So it's crazy how much the digital toolkit has influenced our day to day when it comes to art. And the other day, man, like even music production, man, like holy crap, man. Like I have a piano over there and you know, like I was trying to learn The Man Who Sold the World the other day.
Yo, dope song.
Yeah. And I was like, no, 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 no. And then I just did it on freaking digital. And it was like, man, I just recreated this entire song in digital in 2 minutes. I can't play it for the life of me over there.
You know, in a certain way, it's like, it's very punk rock. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like you, like everybody can do it. And I really like that. Like anybody from, not, I mean, I obviously recognize that technology is expensive, but as it's becoming more and more of a necessity just for day-to-day life, right? Like you can make a song from your phone. I mean, hell, you could draw from your phone. It wouldn't be a lot of fun, but I mean, it wouldn't not be fun, but it would have a lot of limitations, but you can do it. So I like that aspect of it. The only thing is that like, and no shade, but what ends up happening is you see a lot of the same. Mm-hmm. So in terms of my world is what I can speak to. People, there's a big grouping of artists that have a very similar style. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a lot of vector tracing and whatever. And that's dope. Like, that's a thing. But there are people within that world that stand out because they do their own thing in that. And then there are people that are sort of like just sort of seeing the same thing on Instagram and recreating it.
Exactly.
So that's why I chose to sort of get into something that I didn't even read comics for years, man. Like 10 years. I didn't read, like, I'm not, you couldn't ask me like what Peter Parker's great cousin's name is. Like, I don't know that shit. Yeah. But growing up, that was a big thing in my life. And I always really liked the drawings because they were so dynamic. And that's where I was like, you know, that's basketball for sure. And then I can mix that with the dynamicism of comic books.
And it's always a fusion that always works, right? I mean,
for sure.
On our Twitter account, I saw there's an artist. I mean, I'm going to butcher the name, but I think Dana.
Dana. Yeah. Dana draws. Yeah. I think it's Dana too. Yeah.
So I think she made, I wish I knew her Twitter, but she made like playing cards.
Yeah. I saw those. Were
playing cards with basketball. And that's like a great idea, right? I mean, an everyday item fused with the NBA. You know, like in my dumbass old mind, that idea would never even come to me. But the fact that I saw her do it, I was like, oh my God, it's so obvious. So, I mean, all this to say that, you know, once digitization has its own, like, whatever. I mean, you get a lot of commodity art. But the fact that you make it accessible to such a wide array of the population, like, you don't necessarily mm-hmm. need all the painting supplies to create art. You can just do it on your iPad. Just by opening up to the masses, you strike gold once or twice, you know, once in a while. And I think that is the amazing part of digital art.
100%. And accessibility is a big part of what I want to do as well. Like, in terms of making my art accessible for people to have, like, for regular people to have, like, my art on the jerseys, trust me, like, they don't cost nothing to make. Like, there's an investment there. But one of my main goals, I realize this is a different type of accessibility. You're talking about accessibility for people to make the art. I'm sort of accessibility for people to purchase art and have it. One of my main goals with making my jerseys was to make it like as affordable as I could for people. Mm-hmm. Same with my prints. I'm some people sell prints for like $20, and that's fine, but like, I know the business and that's impossible to make money with. But so that's why I open up my price point at like $40, because I want people to have it. I want people to have these memories and moments we all share. Do you know what I mean? Like, doing that, like Kawhi crouching after the shot, like, we were all there. We all remember that moment. We all share that moment. So I want everybody to be able to have it.
Let me ask you this. So, I mean, you probably heard of NBA Top Shot, which is really, NFTs, I believe, right?
Yeah, NFT moments.
Tokens.
Yeah.
And you see it being applied to NBA highlights. Obviously, its roots are in blockchain, and cryptocurrency has a big influence on the concept. Is there something similar for digital art where, you know, I mean, a file can be copy and pasted a million times, but is there something out there which is NFTs, but for art? Like, do you see something like that?
For sure. And people are doing that. Like, there's a lot of NFTs with art going around, like static images, right? That aren't necessarily moments, and they seem to be doing well. What I think is my hesitation with that has been, and again, this is like no judgment, no shade to anybody who's doing it, is that when I was sort of looking into it, an artist by the name of Craig White reached out to me, and he explained to me, which I didn't even think of, the environmental impact of creating these blockchains. So there are, because I guess to create these codes and to do this, it's a huge amount of energy. And every time you transfer them, it's a huge amount of energy.
Yes.
And people don't realize that, like, printing out millions of copies of the art or like millions of jerseys pales in comparison, apparently, to the environmental impact of some of these NFTs. I know that NBA Top Shot uses one, I think, called Flow, which is known to be very environmentally good. So I would be looking into that. And I think it's a good opportunity for people to get into, like, you could own, like, the one I want to do is my Kyle Lowry piece, right, of him holding the trophy. I mean, that's been, by a long shot, my most successful piece, partly because everybody loves Kyle Lowry, including myself.
Right. So. And great point on the, as a tech person, you're bang on. I mean, it's the cost of actually validating tokens on the blockchain is extremely high. I remember a couple of years back, Nvidia's stock price skyrocketed because people weren't buying Nvidia graphic cards for gaming. They were buying it because they're optimized to mine coins. And they're in if you go to some of the Western Chinese provinces, there are basically fields and fields of computers that are doing this. And the crazy part is that there's the electricity part of it for sure, but there's also the part about disposing computers, because these computers don't last more than 3 months because they're under such heavy use that you have to discard 100%. Them and buy new ones every 3 months. And if you compare that to how long you've had your MacBook Pro or I've had my PC, it pales in comparison.
Oh, 100%. And again, like, no judgment to anybody who's doing it. We all got to make a buck, especially artists. Like, it's a good moment for artists, I think. But just, you know, once I found that out, I couldn't, in good conscience, just enter into some of the NFTs. I just sort of decided, it's like, okay, I got to take a step back and do this properly. And I will. I think that I'll go with the Flow NFT, I guess. Like, it shows how little I know just by tone of voice. Like, I'm not confident in which one I'm going to choose and do it. And I just want to make sure it's something that people want from me, because, like, the number one reason I do this, Zerar, is because I think things are dope and I want to share them with people who also think that they're dope. Yeah. So I'm not looking to, like, just cash in, cash out with an NFT. If it's something that people want, then I'll do it, because I'm doing fine, man. Like, I got a good life. I'm happy making my jerseys, and I'm happy making my art, and I'm happy working with, like, the players that I get to work with. If at some point I make an NFT because people want to make it, and of course, like, we all got to make money, we all got to buy groceries. So if that happens to be a side effect of it, great, but it's not my priority.
Yeah. So let's switch to some Raptors talk.
Sure, man.
The season, you know, it's been a weird, you know, obviously it's been a weird season, but let's talk about the recent developments in the Raptors.
Yeah, right? Let's do it.
It sounds like the team is sort of healthy at this point against the Nets last night. We're recording this on today's Thursday. Yeah. Against the Nets last night. They look pretty good. Yeah, the Nets didn't have James Harden or Kevin Durant, but the Raptors looked like the Raptors.
For sure. Especially in the second half.
Even the game before that, they looked more cohesive, even though they didn't have, like, all their guys playing. They still looked like a team that kind of recognizes each other on the court.
100%.
Give me your thoughts on, were you ever, does the idea of tanking, how do you react to when people say we should tank? Like, what is your initial, like, immediate response to that idea?
So my immediate gut response is no, right? Like, because, like, you watch this team. I've watched tanking seasons. I don't even know if I've watched tanking seasons, to be honest. Like, because the Raptors for so many years were so inept. And I think that there's a good portion, and I'm not gatekeeping here. Like, I love everybody who comes on board, but, like, I think that there's a good portion of either younger or newer fans, because I was a newer fan at some point too, but, well, I guess not. I was pretty much here since 95. But anyways, point is, like, how bad watching bad teams is and what tanking really means. Like, the Detroit Pistons have been tanking for how long now? Like, that rebuild started how long ago? Like, it's ridiculous. It's not fun to watch. So that's my gut reaction. Having said that, like, what would we call what the Spurs did? Like wait, for Timmy Duncan, what was that, 96? Is that when that was?
Yeah, and that's a great comparison, man, because I would equate the Raptors tanking to the Spurs, and I have done this in a previous show, because that was opportunistic tanking.
Yeah.
It wasn't deliberately planned at the start of the season. It was circumstance that sort of led to that, and the circumstance in that case was David Robinson getting injured. And they were the Twin Towers, and Robinson got injured. Robinson was kind of always injured. I don't know. Maybe my memory.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's something that we don't really remember, particularly me, because at that time, like, I was born in 87, so I was young. But I have this idea of Robinson, and then you look back and you sort of go like, oh, yeah, he was injured quite a lot, actually.
Yeah, it sort of does feel like, and I think you're right. Some of the fans maybe haven't experienced tanking, because it's not pretty. It's toxic. It's just not a good air around the franchise. The only saving grace on this year's, like, if we had decided to tank, was the fact that it was a short-term one-off thing, not a long-term strategy like the Pistons or the Sixers have adopted. So that was the only part that I kind of was able to swallow.
It's circumstantial. It's entirely, like, I don't believe for a moment that they came into this season attempting to tank. I mean, I think that it's pretty obvious that they didn't, to be honest. Like, nobody expected our center. Nobody expected our center problem to be just this bad as it was, like the black hole at that position. But anyways, that's my gut reaction to it. I understand people thinking about the circumstantial or situational tanking this way. I don't know, losing on purpose just has bad karma attached to it, in my opinion. When has it worked out? Tim Duncan, 100%. But other than that, when has it worked out, really? Yeah. Like, a team has gotten a good player, and then they go win somewhere else.
Here's my thing on tanking. Go ahead and tank, but make sure you pay off the guys in the NBA league office to give you the pick that you
would draft. Yeah, I know, right? To freeze the folder. To free the envelope.
Do the Patrick Ewing Knicks.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, or the LeBron Cleveland thing. So you're insured that you get something out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're going to tank and then leave it to chance, that's dumb. Go to Adam Silver, give him a little nickel.
You think they want Zion in New Orleans? Do you honestly think, like, I don't believe that shit exists anymore, man. I don't think that's even possible. And I'm not even commenting on whether it exists. Like, I'm not a tinfoil hat wearing fan, like, to a certain degree. Although that podcast, what's its name, about the refereeing bullshit that was going on?
With Tim Donaghy?
Yeah. There's this podcast that I can't think of its name now, but they really delve into it. And you just sort of go, like, I'm watching pro wrestling, man. I'm watching the WWE, but I'm not, like, honestly, I'm not a tinfoil hat wearing guy. But if I were, I would say that's over now, because, like, did you see what happened with Zion when they asked him about MSG, about Madison Square Garden? He's like, do you like playing here? He said, other than New Orleans, like, he, like, lit up. First of all, his face just, like, he was like, yeah, like, I love playing here. Da, da, da. And then he caught himself. And then he was like, oh, but, like, other than New Orleans, this is my favorite place to play. And first of all, let's start on one thing here, man. Everybody likes playing in Madison Square Garden. Jordan liked playing in Madison. It's Madison Square freaking Garden, man. It's not that much of a revelation. But what I'm trying to get to is, it's very clear that at least the ESPNs and Bleacher Reports were just, like, foaming at the mouth for that. They're like, post it, post it, post it.
Yeah.
Like, even the Knicks, who have been good, like, I'm not trying to say that they haven't been good. They just got the fourth seed last night, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, third and fourth, yeah.
The hottest
anyways
team in the league.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. But we're a little bit blowing that out of proportion, right?
Okay. Like, I'll leave it at this.
The fact that it's the Knicks, it's getting a little, like, gassed up.
I firmly believe, and I obviously have no evidence, that, you know, in the 80s and 90s, when, you know, the level of transparency and Twitter wasn't there, and a lot of deals could be cut under the table.
Yeah.
It would be very naive to argue the opposite point, that everything is fair and square, especially when you look at the amount of money that is involved. Right. At the end of the day, even though the NBA is not a public league, you're optimizing for shareholder value. And if it makes sense for Jordan to go to the Bulls and the Knicks viewing, of course you do that, because especially at that time in the 80s, the NBA was not about the NBA's primary goal was survival.
100%.
Right? It needed to survive. Yeah. Like the NBA is not today where like whatever, it's the most popular league in North America or whatever it is. Yeah. I don't know. But at the time it was about, can the NBA survive the next 10 years? Because frankly, there were a lot of stereotypes associated with the league at the time, which were hard to sort of break down. And one of the things that David Stern has did, and you know, he did a lot of maybe shady stuff too. I don't know what he did.
For sure.
One of the things he did do, he brought the NBA to the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Right? The NBA was not a mainstream league in the early 80s or certainly the 70s. And he did, and maybe he had to do some things that were a little grayish on the ethical front. So, you know, I'll forgive him.
Yeah.
I'm not hating on him for doing that. I'm just saying there's a strong possibility that it probably.
Yeah. But does it happen anymore? Because Zion Williams is in New Orleans. Like, what is that? Like, that's the second smallest market in the entire NBA, I think.
Yeah.
And I've been to New Orleans, man. Like, they don't care. Like, I don't know if they care now. Like, Zion wasn't there when I went. It was on my 30th birthday. So whatever. Anyways. And like, they didn't care. Like, you barely knew that the Pelicans played in that town. Like, they cared about the Saints and that's it.
Let's talk about positions for a second, because, you know, like traditionally we've always had the 1 to 5, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And one of the talks you hear in, you know, when you talk about Raptors is that, you know, is Fred a 1 or a 2? Or is Siakam a 4 or a 5 or a 3? Is OG here? And I know positionless basketball has been a thing for quite some time now, but I just feel that at this point in the game's evolution, not necessarily just the NBA's evolution, is there an opportunity to sort of rethink the positions?
100%. 100%. I mean, when they're zigging, you got to zag. Like, look, the small ball thing it still is a thing for sure, but like the Warriors changed how everybody was building their rosters, right? Like the big man was looking obsolete for years, and a lot of guys fell by the wayside, like Roy Hibbert just like lost his whole career to that whole sea change, right? I don't know if people recognize that he didn't like fall off a cliff talent wise necessarily. He just became
obsolete,
impotent in the league. Like he just like, what are you going to do? Like his skill set just didn't match the way the league was going. And now with the Lakers do it, like, you know, having just recently coming off of their championship with AD and LeBron and just the way they were building their roster and more like emphasis on bigs. Everybody's sort of like, well, let's just like get bigs. And some teams were hoarding bigs, like just like blatantly, like just like, oh yeah, we'll just get another big. We'll just hoard them. This is an asset everybody wants. You know what it was like, man? It was like NFT data mining. Like they were just like, yeah, I don't know how this fucking works, but I'm just going to get like, you know, as many of these in as we can. So I think it's going that way. In terms of your comment about the positionless basketball, in short, yeah, of course it's a good opportunity. And that's what franchises who win do. That's what people who win do in life, is that they think of a way of doing things differently. They exploit they exploit things that are undervalued, I guess, or exploit chaos or whichever way you want to frame it. I can't articulate that.
I think it's like a blue ocean strategy. If you're in management at all, it reminds me of that, which basically means you zig when everybody else is zagging and you will get an advantage out of it. And one guy that I think, like Pascal Siakam, gets a lot of criticism for for a lot of reasons, which are sort of unfair.
Let's just pause that for a second. Completely unfair. Yeah. Like completely unfair. I just want to emphasize that, like, just like whoever's listening, like completely unfair. Like it's ridiculous. Okay, continue.
I'll tell you what I think is the source of that.
Okay.
And I think people, for some reason, automatically think he is a tier one Steph Curry player and equate him to those standards. And that is so dramatically unfair to the guy that that's where a lot of the Pascal hate comes from, is because they're like, oh, he's underperforming based on these ridiculous standards that we have somehow set for him. It's almost like when Kawhi Leonard left, we automatically said, oh, we still got a tier one player. It's just Siakam. Yeah. So let's start measuring him based on those ridiculously high standards. Now, the guy on his own, I don't know how you feel. To me, he is, this is going to sound stupid, man. So I think he is or can be the Raptors' best playmaker.
Yo, he's just like, they're ridiculous and nobody's paying attention to it. 100% he can be, especially with the attention he draws, right? And that's the other thing that nobody seems to notice. They'll be like, oh, he was like, didn't have like such a great game tonight. Like, did you watch them guarding him the whole game? Like, I'm not sitting here just because like I've done some work with Pascal and I've talked to him a couple times trying to like pretend that you can't critique the guy. When the guy plays poorly, he knows it as well, right? Like, it's just, that's the truth. But or if he's getting doubled or whatever, that there isn't something that he can do that at times he hasn't done. But having said that, like, the way that he play makes is unbelievable. His kickouts, his passes, sometimes so much so to a fault.
Yeah.
Like, and the game where he tried, he double dribbled, basically.
Man, I remember when DeMar DeRozan was here.
Yeah.
One of the things that we wanted DeMar DeRozan to do was, well, there was always three things. It was, can you shoot the ball from three? Mm-hmm. Can you tighten up your dribble? And can you play make? Those were year in, year out, the three things on DeMar DeRozan's to-do list, which he never really got to completely in Toronto. In when he went to the Spurs, he obviously has solved a lot of those problems.
Yeah.
And when I evaluate Siakam against those three criteria, which is ball handling, three-point shooting, and playmaking, I think his playmaking is exceptional.
Like, yeah, I think it's exceptional.
And it's and he has improved, I'd say, by orders of magnitude over the last couple of years. And I don't see any reason why his playmaking aspect can't improve. Three-point shooting has always been about practice and just rhythm, and I believe that will come. My main thing that I wonder if Pascal can tighten up is his dribble. Because if he tightens up his dribble, his playmaking improves. So to me, that's the main to do on Pascal's list for me. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so as well. And I also, like, do you remember his rookie season? Like, I do. Like, I think that Pascal's been a victim of his own success, and that sort of happens sometimes. I think that what happened in 2019 and just how much he rose to the occasion after that, they're like, well, this is just going to be exponential growth. And you're like, well, that's not the way growth works. Like, it happens in jumps. And frankly, he has improved a lot statistically this season. He's also been a victim of COVID, which we don't know the long-term effects of. Like, we don't at all. And you can see it in his conditioning. And frankly, I just sort of think, like, look, this guy's really, really, like, real talented. Like, he has the whole skill set. He's got the body archetype. He's got, like, he can really do something. You know, not to play into your point about, you know, people holding him to a standard of being like a Steph Curry or an Anthony Davis or something like that. Which, I mean, if he wants to shoot for, go for it. And I'm not trying to say that, you know, he can't necessarily reach that, but, I think he's honestly, like, it's probably his shooting, right?
Yeah.
It's his shooting. That's the thing that he's really got to, get more consistent at, especially his three-point shooting, because I'm seeing a lot of them. They're all hitting the back of the iron. Like, they're all too strong, and then he'll overcompensate, and one will just, like, you know, graze the net.
You got to get Dave Hopla in here for summer. shooting coach, legendary shooting coach Dave Hopla. Spend the summer with him, and next
100%. Like also like it's not easy to shoot with like when your wingspan is like 130% of your height or something like that.
What the hell would I know? My wingspan is like 5'4". I don't know.
I know, man. Like what if like moving those arms? It's like a trebuchet. And that's why it's so remarkable when Boucher takes a shot and we all call him trebuchet. Yeah.
All right, Casey, man, thank you for coming on and talking about your art and some basketball. Good luck to you. What's coming up next for you that we can look forward to?
A lot of stuff that I sort of have to keep a little bit on the DL because I have to make legal negotiations now. I have my jerseys. You know, this is the Van Vliet one that I just finished for his 54-point game, which is dope. And then of course there's the Lowry one. So I hope to be doing more art on jerseys soon. But you know how the league be. I just have to make sure that I do that all properly now and get it done right. And some future collaborations, always stuff dropping with Fred. Yeah.
All right, man. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'll
talk to you. You're the best, man. Appreciate you.